This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. Well, thank you. It is the great question. As you remember, know that Anthony Flew had just moved from being an atheist to a theist, but says I could not be a Christian theist because of the problem of evil. Recently, a year ago, Nicholas Wolterstorff, they were doing a kind of a sending-off party from him. He was retiring from Yale, and they had people in. Swinburne is coming and gives his lecture on the probability of the resurrection. And the New York Times said all the questions were answered in this event except the great question that nobody talked about, and that is the problem of evil. Now, if I were talking to atheist, and I assume I am not, maybe assumption I should not make, but I'll accept it that you are not atheist, I would not allow them to let me talk about the problem of evil, because I do not want to prejudice my case. There's no problem. What we would talk about is the argument from evil. That's a different issue. So I would just kind of get the playing field a little evener by changing how I would craft the discussion. But today, we're going to just say the problem of evil because we're all so accustomed to using that language. I don't know, you know, you'd have to keep correcting me, and we don't have time for all of that. So what I would like to handle this is for us to think through the issues and therefore ask questions during the lecture. Raise your hand. If we don't finish the lecture, I believe with all my heart that the sun will still come up in the east tomorrow morning, and Jesus will still come. So you have the information in printed form. So if we don't finish it all today, I'm more concerned with our thinking through the issues because there's confusion even amongst the Christians. What are we up to? And often Christians are answering the question that's not being asked, and therefore it's not at all satisfying. And there is a difference between an argument that says something like this: oh, you atheist, how can you talk about there being good and evil? You don't even believe in God. So how could there even be, you know, how could there be good if you don't believe in God? And we think we've answered the question of the problem of evil. We have not. Now, maybe we've answered another question, but we have not answered the question, why is it that an all good, an omnibenevolent, all powerful, all knowing, sovereign God allows the kind of evil that we see in our world? Now, you can't dispute the evidence, I don't think. What I do dispute is this: the claim is that God does not exist, the evidence is evil, and I say, how do you get from this evidence to this claim? I'd like to know what your warrant is, your justification for making that move. That's how I would deal with the atheist. But as we've already affirmed, you're not atheist, so we will look at it more from the standpoint as Christians, how do we understand the issue that is before us? Well, what are the issues of the subject? If God is creator, did he create evil? This is a much more of a philosophical, but the answer to that is simply no. Evil is not a created entity. It has no essence of its own. And I find in talking to Christian groups, they don't get it. They still think that evil must have an essence. And I'm saying, so you're dualist, is that right? Maybe you're Hindu or something. I don't know. But this does not fit into the theological, Trinitarian, theistic perspective. Augustine was right. In principle, evil is the privation of the good. Aquinas said you couldn't have evil if you didn't have good, because it doesn't have an essence of its own. But I suppose we don't need to linger on that point. You just have to take my word for it. If God is all good and all powerful, why is there so much intense, unequally distributed and suffering of innocence? As I have debated atheists, I will tell you that most of them do not have a problem with a little bit of evil in the world. What they have a problem with is the unequal distribution of evil, the terrible intents. What is it? We talk about Hitler, 6 million, Stalin, 20, and now we know that the Great Leap Forward in China cost something like 30 million lives. But that's remote. What about the children? I was a counselor for some 15 years, and every morning, it seemed, when I would awake, I would hear on the news or the newspaper, television, about a three-month-old baby that was living with a woman and a man, and they were on drugs, and the baby wouldn't stop crying. So the boyfriend goes back and takes the little baby and shakes it until he snaps the thalamus and the baby dies. Or you find a baby that's 5 months old and it's beaten to death with an electrical cord. Now, sit across from a woman who has just had a drunk run over their one-year-old toddler. How do you answer those kind of questions? I suspect these questions are not just in the heart of the unbeliever. I think it's in the heart of the believer. But we have been told, don't ask the question. After all, God is sovereign. He's going to bring some good out of this. So just relax. Well, you might relax, but the cry continues to bubble underneath. But no one dares to talk. Because if you did, someone would think, maybe you're not a Christian, and surely you're not very spiritual. So we want to know, what are the issues? How might we answer them? If God is sovereign, why would he plan a world with so much evil? How could we deny? Well, let's ask ourselves the question. Could God have stopped the Holocaust? What do you think about that? Could God have stopped the Holocaust in terms of his power? We agree on that. And some of you aren't quite sure, but we'll convince you. If God can raise the dead, part the Red Sea, cause the blind to see, surely he could have intervened and stopped it. So what does that leave us with? The great question. Why didn't he? He doesn't love us. I've had people come, particularly females, and tell me that when they were going to school, going to Sunday school, they would sing that song, Jesus loves the little children, all the little children of the world. If you want the rest of that, you have to buy it on CD. She said, when I was 5 years old, a deacon of the church came over to my house, and I was in the backyard, and he raped me. So she said, I grew up, when we were singing that song, I was thinking in my soul, Jesus loves all the little children but me. Because if he loved me, that would not have happened. If God is omnipotent and all-loving, why does he allow the worst of evils? That question, by the way, is a bogus question. I doubt I'll have time to demonstrate that, but that's a bogus question. There are three categories of evil, if we can just think of it for categorization. It's easier to handle the subject if we do this. That is what we call moral suffering. That's more what we think of as sin, the transgression of the law. This is caused by moral agents, killing, stealing, lying, adultery. Then we have what we call natural evil, and that's evil which is caused by nature, being out of joint, something like the tsunami, earthquakes, tornadoes, things of that nature. Then we have physical suffering, and physical suffering is caused by the corruption of the body, things like cancer, heart attacks, genetic aberrations, things of that nature. So this is just to help us to manage the discussion. Are we talking about natural evil, moral evil, or physical evil? Now the questions, why does God allow so much suffering? If you get it personalized, it's like, well, why did God let my father die and he wasn't able to walk me down the aisle and give me away in marriage? Or my dad died before he ever got a chance to see his grandson. That's putting sort of the face on the kind of questions that we get at the pastoral level. And being a pastor for 32 years, I know what some of those are, as many of you. Why does not God protect the children from the terrible suffering? I must confess that this one I struggle with on the surface. Why? Because the Bible says, Jesus says, that they're talking about the little ones, that their angels are before the Father's face always. That's interesting. Then why do children around the globe dying of malnutrition, abuse, etc.? So those are hard questions. We can't pretend they're not there. Or we can just say, if you believed, it would be all settled. Why did God allow such a good man to die so early, which kind of betrays our own thinking? That is, you get what you deserve, and when somebody is good and they get something we think they don't deserve, we're kind of upset about all of that and say, well, you know, if the old drunk down the road, you know, if he'd died at 30, he'd go all right. I mean, he had it coming. But the good, upstanding citizen, the man who loves his family, packs him off to church every Sunday, Wednesday, Friday, Saturday, and just has prayer meeting with his family three times a day, and he dies, we say, So I wonder, do we bargain with God sometimes? Live good so you don't have to deal with the bad. Could God not stop the worst of evils? I've always said that's a bogus question. And then the thing is, could there be any purpose to all of this? The answers we give, and this is the most traditional answer that is given, that God will bring some good from this. This is called the greater good theodicy. It was first crafted by somebody like Augustine. And Augustine said that God allowed only that evil in this world from which he could bring about a greater good or prevent a worse evil. However, the last part doesn't make a whole lot of sense. It's a counterfactual. How would you know whether a worse evil had been prevented, right? Someone says, oh, I would have been happy if I'd have married Jean. Well, how do you know you would have been happier? Well, you know, Bill married her and he's happy. Well, that's just the point. It's Bill and not you, okay? Now, over the years, I've had so many people come to me, and this is what they were told when great tragedy struck their lives. They have said, I was told that God is going to bring some good from this. That was 20 years ago, and we have not seen the good yet. I would say that I'm not enamored with this. Some say it's a mystery. We don't know the mind of God in this matter, and that confuses me. Because on the one hand, we claim that the Christian worldview has superior answers to the tough questions of life, and the toughest questions that comes before us is the problem of evil. We say, oh, I surrender. That's a mystery. I don't know what's going on here. Well, doesn't that sound a little self-serving? If Christianity is superior worldview that does answer the great questions of life, it seems that the greatest question is the problem of evil. The other one is that God's knowledge does not extend into the future, and this, of course, is the position of people like Greg Boyd and the people who are the openist persuasion. That is, God couldn't stop the Holocaust because he didn't simply know it was going to happen. Of course, we don't know after, I guess one could say, after he killed 1,000, God couldn't be sure that he'd kill, the other 5,900,000 that were out there. I would disagree with that as well. I think God does know all future events, including those of his moral agents. I think God knows what I'm going to do the next moment. I think he knows what I'm going to do a year from now, where I will be a year from now, as well as everybody else. So I think I'm holding a classical view of theism. That's how I would understand God's omniscience. So we have these. And then the fourth answer that we give is that God is judging people for their disobedience to him. Now, I want to ask, is it possible that God could bring some good out of evil? Is it possible? Surely. Remember, that's not our question. The question is not what God might do with evil. The question is, how is God morally justified in allowing the evil? And it's fallacious to argue backward from what God does with evil to why God allowed evil. Do you see the problem? Almost invariably, people will say, well, there was some good that came out of it. That's why God allowed it. And I've said in other places, you don't argue that consequences explain or justify the cause. If a young lady married a man who was unsaved, assuming that you agree with me that believers should only marry believers, and if a woman marries an unbelieving man, and then later on, 3 years later, the man gets saved, do we say that it's okay? The reason that God had her marry the unsaved was so he could bring it to Jesus. Well, I don't think that makes a lot of sense. Why? Because that makes sin relative to consequences. If it all turns out okay, then it ceases to be sin. Well, we don't argue that way. Whoops, excuse me. I've already told you, I don't think mystery, but are there some things about evil that we don't understand? Of course there are. You can confess up to that. If there are three children in the back seat of a car, there's an automobile accident, one is killed, the other two walk away unharmed, no scratches, I cannot tell you why it was that this one died and the other two. That is a question beyond what I can answer. But I'm not being called upon to answer that question. And it's always wise to know what questions can be answered and which ones can't. And this idea of God judging their people, is it possible that sometimes we see suffering in the world and it is a direct result of God's judgment? Is that possible? Is it? Certainly we see in the Bible, do we not? Now, what's the problem? Now, you remember in 9/11 when the trade towers were struck, we had some of our evangelical luminaries in the West who flocked to the cameras to tell the world that the reason that the trade towers had been struck was God was judging America for its homosexuality and its abortion clinics. I just thought to myself, I mean, just on the face of it, that didn't make a lot of sense to me. If I were going to judge America for homosexuality, I would have hit the West Coast, not the East Coast. And I don't think there are any abortion clinics in the trade towers. Well, as you know, 3 days later, they came back to the cameras and said, well, we're sorry. That wasn't quite right. And we apologize. And during the tsunami, there was a gentleman of my, we won't mention any names, who said, a very influential person, who said the reason that the tsunami, the reason that the tsunami came was it was God's judgment on Southeast Asia for the Islamic, it was a judgment on Islamic states for the way they had treated Christians. Now, we agree that it's possible that God could judge, right? We're not saying that's not the case. What is the problem? We simply don't know. In the Bible, we do know, right? When Sodom and Gomorrah get it, do you know why they got it? This was not a coincidental event. It was an act of judgment by God for their sinfulness. That's the difference. So when somebody says, this happens because God is judging so-and-so, I'm saying, how do you know that? I'm not saying it isn't a possibility, but remember, we are now trying to build an argument for why God is morally justified in allowing evil as it exists in our world. What should we do? Well, we should consider that the Christian worldview claim, I've already suggested, if it's superior to other worldviews, then it ought to have an answer. One of the persistent questions of humanity is the problem of evil. How many of you, when you've witnessed, that's become an objection? Somebody says, evil. Yeah, exactly. And it takes different forms, doesn't it? By the way, because we're certainly not going to get through all this material, so let me just be clear about something. Am I saying that my response is going to convince the unbeliever? No. I don't think that's my first responsibility. Well, my first responsibility is that I have an answer to the problem of evil that is theologically consistent with my total worldview, that I am rational in holding the views that I hold. Whether it's convincing to the unbeliever, I do not determine the truthfulness of any argument based upon how many people it convinces. Truthfulness is determined on other grounds, not its effectiveness. However, I would hope that all true arguments are effective. And I would say it's not only an academic issue, it's a pastoral issue. It must be answered by leaders of the community of faith. I debate atheists, and this is an issue that comes up. But my first encounter with the whole matter of the problem of evil was as a pastor for 32 years, and in my last church for 22 years. And you get to deal with all kinds of things, all sorts of suffering, bad things. It's easy, folks, to preach a message on Sunday morning if you don't have to live it on Sunday morning, if you don't have to live it on Monday morning. And it's great to preach a message for somebody else to live if you don't have to live it. But when people of your congregation sit in front of you and say, now what, Pastor? Now you see. Unless you can slip on Bilbo's ring and become invisible, you've got to face the music. So most of what I share with you is not from the academy. It's from out there, working with people day in and day out, trying to bring comfort. The question before us, if God exists, why does he allow such acts of terrible intents, awfully unequally distributed? 2 points must be made. What is God like? And if God is not there, then of course there is no question, is there? If there's no God, then so what? If he is there, then we must understand him to be as he is and not as we want him to be. I think we have, in evangelicals, we have been guilty of putting things on God's shoulders that he never put there himself. And then we have to end up defending it. If God is there, how does he work in this world? How does the infinite being relate to the finite being in a way that's meaningful and consistent? That question is seldom asked. We just assume that we know the answers to it. But I would suggest that that is an area that's been terribly neglected by our evangelical theologians. When we want to start talking, we want to start talking with the Gospel of John. I think we need to start talking with the book of Genesis. That's extremely important. That's where things are being laid down so we can understand what is to follow. I don't think we have a discussion here, but I'm just outlining. I would say God is omnipotent. I will only call that absolute in power. I could define it in other ways, but certainly it isn't defined as God can do anything, right? You know, somebody said, well, God can do anything. And somebody said, well, he can't do this. And I know it. That's right, he can't do that. Well, he can't do, oh, yeah, that's right, he can't do that. And all of a sudden, our definition dies the death of 1,000 qualifications. So, a word to all of us, be precise with our language, accurate in our definitions. It will save us just a lot of trouble. I think many of the debates that rise come because we have not been precise with our language. We like to make God big, so we're not precise. God's omniscient, comprehensive in knowledge. Yeah, that's right. He's omnipresent. The devil did that one. We have two omniscience here, but I do know the difference. That should be omnipresent. He is complete in presence. All of these could be discussed. He is sovereign. And here I may depart with some of you. I think that we often talk about the sovereign hand of God. I think we ought to talk about the providential hand of God. And there is a difference. But I know we shouldn't get into theology. I mean, this is apologetics. What in the world do those two have to do with one another? God is just, isn't he? I was just reading this morning, couldn't sleep, so I decided to get up and read the book of Job, sitting on the commode. It wasn't because the book of Job affected me that way or anything. It's just it seemed to be the best place for me to go that I didn't disturb my roommate. And thought I would read the book of Job, and there it talks about God being just. Because of this, he is able to work providentially in this world. He is a simple being in that he is not divisible and always acts as a whole, although certain attributes may be more evident one time than another. When we talk about God, we begin to divide him up as if God only acts in omnipotence or he only acts in omniscience. But I hold to the notion of the Trinitarian God, who is a simplistic God. He is indivisible, and when he acts as a Trinitarian God, and he acts as his total being. Now, is it true that some of his attributes are more evident at times? Well, surely, but it is never one attribute that is acting out here by itself, whether it be sovereignty or omnipotence. It's always in as a holistic sense. Now, I don't think I'm saying anything new. I'm only speaking to remind us. Now, who God is does not usually present a point of controversy with us, so we won't worry about that. Therefore, I want to move to the second question, which I think is the most often ignored, and that is, how does God work in this world? And it may seem that that has a very simple answer to it, but I think it does not. Although we affirm God, what God is like as a Trinitarian God, the question before us is, how does he apply his attributes to this world? Does he work within a divinely determined, prescribed, created order? And if so, would this help us in any way to understand evil in this world? And that will be my basic thesis. That God has, before he ever created anything, God not only determined what he would create, God also determined the rules by which he would engage this creation, in which he would have a meaningful relationship with man. Now, why did God do that? He just chooses to do it. Who makes up the rules, so to speak? God in his sovereignty does. And it's okay. The clay can't say to the potter, why is it like this? If God did it, the rules, as it were, of this world, I think God in his wisdom, his understanding, has designed a way in which this world operates. What might it look like? Well, God was morally free to make man in his image. That is, that's an assumption that we can make, but I don't think anybody can find anything wrong with that assumption that God is free to make man in his image. And part of that image is what I would call the power of moral choice. Now, I do not like the word free will. So, to me, it's one of those imprecise words because none of us are free. If you think so, I've got a little project for you. If you think you're free to do anything you want, go try flying. Jump off a high building and suspend yourself in midair. I'm using very silly things, but we are not free in that sense. But I do think we have the power of moral choice, and it is essential if we are going to love. Here's my mantra. This whole discussion talks about the power of choice to choose right and wrong. I think that's not the first real big issue here. I think the first real big issue is we need to have the power of moral choice to be able to love God. That is the highest function of any human being, is it not? When Jesus is asked, what's the greatest commandment, what does he tell him? It's what? To love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, strength, and mind. And oh, don't forget the last one. And the second is likened unto it, thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. Now we have got the church today. We think the highest function of mankind is to win a soul to Jesus. I'm not belittling that. That makes the church task-oriented. That means that we, sooner or later, and I think it was sooner, we weren't concerned about how we did it. We were only concerned with accomplishing the end. That is, seeing people come to Jesus, which I think has brought a lot of questionable methodology into the church. But when the main thrust is understood to be to love the Lord my God with all my heart, will I then be concerned about winning people to Christ? But I'll also be concerned with what? How I do it. Because the method is important. The method must be theologically, it must be something that could be offered to God as our worship, our sacrifice, as a work of love. The term moral I'm using in the basis sense. Now, not everybody is going to agree that man has libertarian freedom. I just happen to be of that persuasion, and some of you can. But don't let that disturb you right now. I think we can work through this. Love, by most standards, is considered the ultimate human act. By Jesus, love sponsors acts of courage, compassion, acts of encouragement. I was just reading, an article from an evolutionist from London who was just amazed that she's talking about how that she was so happy that she was an evolutionist. And yet everything in her article, I would have thought, would have brought her to think, I don't want to be an evolutionist. Because she said, it's just amazing that man is a compassionate being. But I don't think she has any real explanation for why he is, but Christianity does. Because love sponsors those sort of things in loving our neighbor. Without the power of moral choice, one cannot love. And without love, humanity would not be humanity. I don't know if you think about this much. Can you imagine that the infinite God has created the structure of this world morally in such a way that you can love him, he accepts your love, and it's a meaningful relationship? Imagine that. That's pretty amazing. And what is necessary to all of that? The fact that man can have a power of choice. Do you think that love, and I'll use this word, entails the ability to choose? I know you're out there. I can hear you breathing. Yes, it does it not? Imagine that the mommy, daddy comes home, the little child is in the driveway, in the yard, all grumpy. He says, dear, what's the matter? I hate mommy. Oh, now listen, you go and tell mommy you love her. No, I won't. If you don't tell mommy you love her, I will beat the snot out of you. Okay. So the little boy goes in and he says, mommy, I love you. And he goes off. Well, he prevents any disastrous happenings to his anatomy. So that's one case. Now, what about the same little boy, a girl, who the next day, mommy is sitting in the chair, crawls up in her lap, puts his arms around her and says, mommy, I love you. Now, which one of those do you think is true love? Of course, it's the latter. It's simple. God, if God forced us, it wouldn't be love. That's why we need the power of moral choice, which entails choosing right and wrong as well. At a point, God decides to create, which includes all of nature and mankind. Adam and Eve were not perfect, but they, in the sense that God is perfect, but they were flawless. They were perfect as a contingent being could be. However, because man was created, he was limited. And that's not a flaw. Contingent beings are limited. That's just the way we are. And man has been fighting against that ever since his 2 feet hit this earth. To overcome their creatureliness, they decided to not love God, which is demonstrated by disobeying God in an attempt to be like God. I would argue that what's going on in the garden is, yes, it's disobedience, but it reflects that they ceased to love God and began to love themselves. They wanted to be like what? God. Do you think a lot has changed? Because he was over all creation felt the consequences of sin, and from this flows, either directly or indirectly, all suffering and pain in this world. So at the root of everything, moral evil, physical evil, natural evil, it all at the bottom of this is because of sin. As Francis Schaeffer used to say, the world is out of joint, horribly out of joint. I do indicate that there are some satanic forces, but we'll move beyond that. Prior to God creating anything, God established an order for his creation. This order determined how God would interact with his creation, how creation would operate. And God has even put a lot of that into writing, has he not? When God gives us a command, that's how he wants us to respond to him. And when he gives us a promise, it tells us how he will respond to us. Do you like the fact that God keeps his word? That he's let you know up front what he will do for you and what he expects of you? God created a physical order for his creation. No, I don't think there's any debate here. And this determines how things work in the physical world, both at the molecular and at the cosmic level. And it does limit possibilities. But I'm concerned with the moral order that God established for the universe. This moral order is reflected at least minimalistically in the Ten Commandments, right? Yes, we have something about how we should live. And it does explain minimalistically God's relationship to man, man's responsibilities to God, and to his fellow man. This order makes possible or includes a number of realities for man. And I would just say some of these realities, I'm not exhaustive, but they would be the possibility of obedience, of love, the possibility of having compassion and justice. We can have that because that's the way God has morally structured the universe. It's the power of moral choice. I would say there are other things like the matter of forgiveness is just a part of this order. So that if I sin against God and there are consequences for my sin, is it possible that if I confess my sin that the consequences could even be reversed? You take a case like Nineveh, for example, right? Does God say you're going to be destroyed in 3 days? But they're not. Well, why aren't they? Because they repented. And there's a law that's at work, as it were. This is part of the moral structure of the universe. I suggest that there are two minds. The necessary mind, the mind of God, and the mind of man. And what God does is he has these two minds so they can interrelate, interact in a meaningful way. This is no piece of theater, folks, when the Bible says to love God with all your heart, to worship him, to sacrifice to him, to think about his coming again, to think God's thoughts after him. That's not just nice rhetoric that we throw around in that Christian community to sound good. No, that's not just convenient that we use this language. This is the way things really are. And I didn't create it this way. God did. God has made it in this moral structuring of the universe so that the redeemed mind, of course, now after the fall, but prior to the fall, these two minds interacted meaningfully. God could come in, tell Adam this. Adam understood. He could tell Adam, name the animals. Adam could go do that. And somehow Adam's mind was in some shadow form of God's mind, that as he named the animals, that was precisely as God would have him name the animals. The necessary mind creates the contingent mind, which is compatible with God's mind. But the contingent mind, the mind of man, cannot overrule the mind of God. The decisions of man cannot overrule the counsels of God. God limits in his dealing with mankind some of his non-moral divine attributes in order that man can have true freedom. And we see that, of course, when Jesus comes into the world. Well, when the Word comes into the world, we know Jesus. So that God, wrapped in flesh, really comes to humanity without humanity dying. Why? How can such a thing be? Certainly, it's not that God ceases to be God in the flesh. This is one of these marvels and illustrates, in my thinking, how God interacts with his creation. And we see it very nicely manifested in the incarnation, not something that we can develop right now. And the freedom that God gives man permits man to make choices within what I would call a range. I believe that there are the counsel of God, Isaiah 45 through 46, and God has a range. And you can make choices within that range, and it will not affect the predetermined outcome of the flow of human history. What about Hezekiah? 2 Kings 20. Isaiah comes to Hezekiah and tells him what? Get your house, you're going to die. Before Isaiah gets back home, God comes to him and says, go back and tell Hezekiah what? You're not going to die. But then the reason for that is given. I've heard your prayer and I've seen your tears. Therefore, you shall not die. And God gave him another 15 years, but I would think only 15 years, not more than that. That's all he could get and stay within the bounds of this range. Yes. Yes. I say non-moral because I'm thinking of his being truth, being just. He would not, those would always be at work. His omnipotence was not. When he's on the cross, you know, he could have called, as the hymn says, 10,000 angels. I just say non-moral because I don't think he restricts his moral attributes like love, truth, justice, if they are indeed attributes. But we'll pretend they are for today because it's going to work good for me. And that's all that's important today, folks, that things work good for me. Okay. And I'm not really trying to slip you a Mickey or anything like that, you know. It's just, okay. Now, this freedom is what makes it possible. It's the basis for justice and peace. Man is influenced by antecedent choices. What I would want to do is move a little bit further down. So, because of our time, God creates a material world and creates man who has a mind, which in turn shapes I say much, but at least some of how history unfolds. Your choices within this range help shape how history unfolds. Under the conditions of contingent beings having the power of moral choice, I would argue this is the best of all possible worlds. Now I sound like Mr. Pangloss, according to Voltaire, but because Leibniz believed that this is the best of all possible worlds, I do think it is. Now, you have to understand, when I say the best of all possible worlds, I use the word world, as did Leibniz, and as I think the Bible does, to speak of everything from the moment of creation all the way to the day of regeneration. That is the world. There are different ages in the world. You say, you sound like a dispensationalist. No, I'm just saying there are different ages. The Bible says in 2 Corinthians 4, what? That Satan is the god of this world? He's the god of this age. So I see the world, oh sure, at this moment, can you think of things being a little bit better than they are right at this moment? Yes. But that's not what I mean when I say this is the best of all possible worlds. I'm saying this is the best of all possible worlds when you take it in it from the day of creation to the day of regeneration. I would argue that on a very deductive argument, and that is in Genesis 1:31, when God looks at all that is made and says it's very good. If God did not create his best at the day of creation, then there is a moral complaint against God, is there not? He did not do his best. Now, either he did not do his best or he could not do his best, in which case there must be a God greater than him who could have done it, and therefore we ought to worship that God and not this demiurge. So, gosh, that is a real quick statement of a very deep subject. This being the best of all possible worlds. Someone might ask, well, couldn't there be a world where there was a better world than this one, maybe with less suffering? And I would just answer, no. The Christian would have to answer this way. If there could have been a better world, then that's the one we would live in. Now, some would argue that God actually allowed sin to come into the world because by sin he was actually going to bring about a better state, a better world. Now, if that's true, folks, then J.L. Mackey is right. There is something that God cannot do, namely create this better world without the use of sin. Do you really think that your God needs sin to do a better job than what he could do just from his creative powers? I don't think so. Now you realize that everyone, yes, thank you. Yeah. Well, on your first point, I've heard the argument. I don't know if you were making the argument or you were just simply suggesting that would be an argument. That is, that the love of God. Well, folks, I would have to argue that the best world would be a world where there was no need of a cross. Would you not think so? Wouldn't that be the best world? A world where there was no need of a cross? Do you not think that Adam and Eve sensed the love of God in its purity in the garden? I think about people who, as they live older, and they get into a lot of sin, and then they come to Jesus, and everybody says, oh boy, I sure wished I had a testimony like that. Oh, they really know the forgiveness of God. And I'm thinking, folks, as one who lived late, before I came to Jesus, I wish I would have come to Jesus much earlier in my life because there are a lot of things that are in my memory that I wish were not there. I don't need to be in the gutter to know the wonderful grace and mercy of God. When God saves the five-year-old, that is as much a demonstration of his love and grace as when he saves my dad, when he saved him at 35 as an alcoholic farmer. Now, I know how we look at that. I understand there's a perspective here as human beings, and we say, isn't that marvelous? And it was marvelous when my dad came to Christ. But the argument is that, you know, oh, here we have this. This gives a great opportunity for God to show his love. I'm saying God doesn't need the cross to show his love. Does the cross show his love? Yes. But how much better the world if it would never had to be in the first place? I think. Would you respond? Do you think that's a legitimate response? Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think it is also, I think Romans chapter 6, though it deals with a different principle, but the same idea, shall we sin that grace might abound? And the response to that is, God forbid. So, I'm not persuaded, you may have an argument, but I'm not persuaded of that argument. Remember now, there are many issues here to talk about. And I tell people when we talk about this, do you realize, if you talk about the problem of evil, you will touch every major doctrine of theology. And that's why an hour will I don't know how long the Nicene Council met, but I'm sure they had more than an hour to get some of these things worked out. So I'm sure we're not going to get that done. What I want to do it just here in our closing moments, if I may, is to make this argument. Here's what I would argue. Because of the moral structure of the universe, that God is faithful to his order, that there is such a thing as gratuitous evil in this world. That means evil that has no purpose. That does not mean that God does not know about it, but that if I were to walk down the aisle and slug one of you hard enough to knock you out or knock a tooth out, I am not willing to say that that happens so that some greater good might come from it. I would simply say that there is evil in this world that has no point to it. Abortion is one. Slavery is another. And you can go on down the line. That's why God calls us to fight for social justice. Because these evils do not have any purpose other than a destructive force in God's creation. If all evil is allowed by God, the evil that we see in this world is allowed by God to bring about a greater good, then you ought to step back once you see the evil and let the good come. There are actually evangelicals, I could mention their names, but I won't, who actually believe that this is determined to be the worst of all possible worlds, simply because the more evil in the world, the more good there would be in the world. Do you like that argument? It seems to be somewhat fallacious to me. Well, maybe not fallacious, but certainly in my thinking against the Bible. I am called to stand against the social injustice. I stand against abortion. I stand against euthanasia. I stand against embryonic stem cell research and things of this nature. Why? I think I'm called to do that. I don't see that evil as coming into the world. Someone says, well, that's the good. The good is that you stand up for it. That's the good. You stand up for it. I say, well, what do you do with something like slavery that went on in our country in America and in England for a number of years? What do you do with all the suffering that came before anybody stood up against it and it was stopped? I just think it's a terribly weak argument. But if, and this is precisely where the atheist hits us. The atheist says to us, so God lets evil into the world because he's going to bring some good from it. And then the next question for us is, where's the good? Some of you remember the old ad about the hamburger, the old lady who stepped up to this counter and she said, where's the beef? Well, the atheist asked the question, where's the good? And there are all kinds of questions that have come up. Answers. Swinburne he just does all kinds of funny things to try to demonstrate the good. This is what I would say. Do I believe that God can bring about good out of evil? Absolutely. I would only argue that is not my moral justification for God allowing it in the first place. That it is here because God has a moral order. Can God intervene providentially anywhere along the way? Yes, often in response to the prayers of the church, right? God can intervene. So I'm saying providentially, God can intervene. God can answer our prayers, whether it be physical suffering, whether it be moral or whatever. God can answer prayers. God can, but he has not committed himself to do that by promise or by covenant. If he does, it's his own good will and purposes in answer to our prayer. So what do I tell somebody when they come to me and they're suffering? I don't tell them that there is some good that's coming out of all of this. I do what I think seems to me to be the biblical thing. Rather than having them focus on the good, I have them focus on the God. The God of the 2 Corinthians 1, 2 through 4. He's the Father of mercy, the God of all comfort. His grace is always sufficient. When you step through the waters, the Christian community is looking around to find some good. Just recently in my church, not my church where I pastor, where I attend, a grandmother was driving the little grandchildren, and she had a grandchild in the front seat. She should not have been there, and they had an accident. The bag released and broke the little girl's neck. It was a 2-year-old. What did the church tell the mom and dad? God willed this to bring about a greater good. Now, I will tell you that down the road, there are going to be some serious issues with this family, and there already are. I was teaching this, and a young man who's in that church came to me weeping. He said, "Can you possibly speak to these young couple? They are in deep trouble emotionally right now." Well, we don't help people if we don't tell them the truth. So I would say, yes, maybe there is gratuitous. Do I know when it happens? No. I'm just saying that's possible. And what's my responsibility? I fight against the evil as much as I possibly can, wherever I find it. And in doing so, I don't think I'm short-circuiting the good at all. Okay, we got just a couple of minutes. I really hit this really quick, but I would be open to questions. And surely you think the guy's off his wee head. And yes. No, I would not appeal to mystery. I appeal to the Bible. Do I have cases where God has intervened? Affirming that I do not know when it happens is not an appeal to mystery. A mystery is an appeal to what I don't know why it would happen. This is I don't know when. I can't look at some evil and say, that's gratuitous, or that's got a purpose behind it. I can't make those judgments. That's all. So it's not mystery that I'm appealing to. I'm just saying, but why can I say it's either? Well, I have a word from God. And why might God intervene? Well, I see he does it in the Old Testament, the New Testament. Doesn't have to, but does he? Yes. In answer to prayer? Yes, sometimes. Do you think God ever intervenes without you ever offering a prayer? I suspect God has intervened in our lives without us ever knowing it. Now, that's just a suspicion. But I wouldn't say, I'm not appealing to mystery to explain why evil is in the world. I have why God is morally justified in allowing this evil. Because when God says, you eat of the tree, death will come, and what we are seeing are the outworkings of death. The sin in the world, both physical, moral, and natural. That's why God morally justified, yes. Well, now, I would argue that the Bible does say something about that. I would say Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, address that issue. Yes, I would say most commentators would take that because when it talks about that, you're Lucifer and you in the garden of God, obviously it's gone beyond the king of Tyre at that point. So, yes, I would say the Bible gives an answer to that question. It is a question we have to answer. I came in at the bottom level with man.
Origins of evil that come from fact that the serpent was already in the garden.
Well, we just take it straightforward and deal with it unashamedly as the Bible deals with it. I would say that most people that I've ever dealt with don't raise that issue. but we must be prepared to deal with it. And I think the Bible does, the two texts that I have given you. And, you know, then we can go to the New Testament and we actually see Paul talking about, you know, Satan hindered me. So we know it goes on. That's not so much, I think, your question. Your question is, well, how did it get into the angelic conflict, in the angelic realm? And I'd say, well, Isaiah 14, Ezekiel 28, deal with that issue. Okay? Yeah. Yes.
Sorry, I think in a sense the force of the question is that that was just made just now is that if evil was pre-existent to the world, how is it that this world is the best possible world that you've described? If it's not just that man's moral choice was involved, but also Satan or the angel's moral choice, in a sense it seems to skew human choice by the pre-existence of angelic evil choice, to the point that it makes it very difficult for us, in a sense, to blame the sin of Adam and Eve, which is hard enough to see all death, disaster, disease, and the horrors of history and the horrors of hell mm-hmm. coming from the choice of the first couple, if that choice of the first couple is also undermined by the fact that there's a pre-existent angelic choice. Do you see what I mean?
I hear that. I hear the question. I'm not going to answer it. No, I'm just kidding. It's not that I don't hear the question, I'm just not going to answer. No, I would say that when we look at the garden, that mankind, the scales were clearly tipped away from man making that bad choice. Eve and Adam both failed to ask the most important question. By what authority do you speak? They are ones who had Yahweh come into the garden in the cool of the day. They knew clearly to whom they owed their existence. Now, if God would have not done all of that, then you might have some kind of an argument. But I'm saying God did everything to skew it, as it were, in the favorable way, to do everything to keep that, in a sense, from happening, apart from determining that it couldn't happen, which would take away the power of choice. So I don't know if that's a satisfactory answer to you, but that's how I would see that. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, one last question, I think.
I hope I can formulate it clearly what I think. Sometimes I feel the problem might be that we try to integrate the experience of evil into our thinking. And I'm just now asking my question, shouldn't I more often be enraged by the sheer... No, by looking at the evil in the world and listening to the news sometimes, and then turn to God and say, well, what do you think about it?
But I don't think that is, I don't think that those two concepts are mutually exclusive. It is what I have just said and what you're saying. I never stand at a funeral, I believe, I can say this honestly without weeping, just to what sin has done. Angry, in a sense, that it's robbed a family of a loved one. When I visited hospitals, there were times I would sense myself getting angry, not at God, but at the outrage of evil. But having said that, what that does is drive me back to God and thank him for the way he has worked when he didn't have to rescue us from all of that, and the great hope of the eschaton that will come, regardless of what Satan's forces may try to do or what sin may do. It is a defeated foe. But, yeah, I think if Christians don't sense an outrage against evil, I listen to Christians and I think they sometimes romanticize evil. The little boy who just buried his daddy and he's crying and the preacher says, now, sonny, don't cry. God needed him more than you. I'd like to kick him in the pants. That's a silly response. Do I get angry when I go to a home of a young man who just took his own life and left a young lady and two children to rear on her own? I don't get angry at him. I just get angry at sin. Is that all right? I'm outraged by it. But I don't think those things are mutually exclusive, even though I know I live in the best of all possible worlds. Okay, thank you. Thank you. All right. That's it.
Thank you very much, Bruce.